From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, City Streets, Basketball Dreams, we talk with journalist Darcy Frey about the version of the American dream played out on the basketball court. Frey spent a year at a Coney Island high school following four young basketball players. In his new book, The Last Shot, Frey says playing for a college scholarship has become a cruel parody of the American dream. Also, behind the scenes of an advertising campaign that didn't work, Randall Rothenberg is the former advertising columnist of the New York Times. His new book looks at Subaru's failed attempt to establish a new image through advertising. And classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a new recording of Stravinsky scores adapted for solo piano. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. House Republicans have named Newt Gingrich House Speaker. The GOP caucus this morning confirmed the Georgia congressman by a voice vote with no dissenters. In his nominating speech, Texan Henry Bonilla called Gingrich a visionary and said his rule would go down in history as a turning point for America. The Democratic Leadership Council is responding to the changeover of power in Congress by offering an alternative to the Republican contract with America. NPR's Carolyn Clark Kelly has more.
The group of moderate to conservative Democrats is calling for a GI Bill for American workers, including vouchers to pay for job retraining programs and tax breaks for education-related savings. The DLC contract also includes ideas for overhauling welfare, housing programs, and health care. The group's president, Al Fromm, says by enacting its proposals, Democrats could recapture the political center.
We are alerting the Republicans that we intend to engage them in hand-to-hand combat for every inch of ground on the battlefield of ideas.
Fromm sought again to distance the DLC somewhat from the president, who at one time headed the group, saying the DLC will work to promote its own ideas separate from the administration. I'm Carol Ann Clark Kelly in Washington.
Senate Republicans say there should be no more reductions in defense spending. The Republican leaders of the Senate Armed Services Committee say the military has been hurt too deeply by budget cuts. NPR's Elizabeth Arnold reports.
The chairman of the Armed Services Committee, John Warner, says the Defense Department has become a piggy bank that's being robbed to pay for other domestic programs. Warner and Arizona Senator John McCain are requesting that funding for defense be kept at its current level.
Our bottom line is if we can just get in the State of the Union message another commitment from the President of the United States, level funding of 1996 budget as 1995. That's the key.
McCain says, quote, draconian measures are necessary when one-fourth of the nation's army divisions are in a state of unreadiness. McCain added that he and Warner will be drafting legislation to require the president to petition Congress for emergency funding within 60 days of using troops in peacekeeping missions. I'm Elizabeth Arnold at the Capitol.
A new report says college graduates may have an easier time finding a job next year than in years past. A Michigan State University survey of more than 500 businesses indicates hiring of recent graduates will be up 6%. More airlines have cut ticket prices in an effort to fill seats during the holiday travel season. Northwest Airlines started the trend over the weekend, then Delta jumped in with what it said were even deeper discounts today, and five other airlines quickly followed Delta's lead. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down 10.43 at 3735.19 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Treasury Secretary Lloyd Bentsen says reports that he's about to resign are premature. Bentsen commented briefly on his way to the National Press Club. He told reporters, "When I have more information, I'll let you know." Today's Wall Street Journal says Bentsen is expected to resign by early next year. White House sources have confirmed the report. Some administration officials suggest there's pressure on Bentsen to stay, but he hasn't made up his mind yet. Federal regulators today warned that the gap between the pensions promised to American workers and the money actually set aside to cover them has reached $71 million. UPI's Pi Chamberlain has the story.
Labor Secretary Rice says 8 million workers risk not getting their pensions because their pension funds are in trouble. He said in most cases, the businesses that have the problems are in other respects financially healthy. Furthermore, he said a new bill attached to the GATT trade bill that passed last week will cut the problem by two-thirds over the next 15 years and mean that
the pensions of American workers will be safer.
He says most of the pension shortfall is in the auto, steel, tire, and airline industries. The shortfall went up by a third last year, mostly because low interest rates cut the earnings of pension fund investments. Pye Chamberlain, Washington.
President Clinton is urging European nations to join together to prevent more ethnic conflicts like the Bosnian Civil War. Speaking in Hungary at the Conference on Security and Cooperation in Europe today, the president said we must act on the lessons of Bosnia. Also at the Hungary meeting, Bosnia's president bitterly attacked NATO for not doing enough to stop the fighting. He said Western inaction was prolonging the war. Meanwhile, a UN spokesman in Bosnia is demanding that Serb forces release more than 300 peacekeepers detained for nearly 2 weeks. Serbian leaders had promised to free the UN troops over the weekend, but they continue to hold them as a shield against possible NATO airstrikes. The spokesman said the Serbs are also blocking food convoys. I'm Laura Kanoy in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Basketball is more than a game to many young men in the inner city. It's the ticket to a better future. For some young men, a basketball scholarship may provide the only shot at a college education and a decent job. Added to that, of course, is the chance to play in front of millions of ESPN viewers and the possibility of making it to the NBA. Basketball offers hope, but to many young men, it's a false hope. My guest, Darcy Frey, is the author of the new book, The Last Shot, City Streets, Basketball Dreams. He spent a year following four players on the basketball team of Lincoln High in Coney Island. This part of Brooklyn, which was famous for its amusement park, is now a neighborhood Frey describes as having almost no stores, no trees, no police, nothing but block after block of gray cement housing projects. Frey says there are no jobs. Simply put, there is basketball, and when that doesn't work, there are drugs.
These kids have come from such uniformly impoverished circumstances and poor educational backgrounds that the chance that's dangled in front of them to win a college scholarship, get a four-year degree, and hopefully a decent job afterwards is really the only way out. These kids, you know, their educational backgrounds are so bad that they're scoring something like, you know, a combined 700 on the SATs. They've got pretty low grade point averages, and if it weren't for the idea of a basketball scholarship, they wouldn't be going to college, and they'd be sort of rooting around in the neighborhood for the rest of their lives, like so many of their older brothers and older friends.
So basketball means more than just the opportunity to play, the dream of playing in the NBA. It's a ticket to college.
Yeah, exactly. I think we have this idea that there are all these inner city kids out there, and they're all deluded into thinking that they're going to win multi-million dollar contracts in the NBA. The kids that I wrote about were actually quite coldly realistic in their appraisal of their options in life, and one of the things they wanted to do was use their aptitude and skill at basketball to get to a four-year school and get a bachelor's degree, and even that was out of reach for a lot of the kids.
What are the courts like in Coney Island where the kids you wrote about play on?
Well, Coney Island now, I mean, there is this, I think it's a, we have this historical notion that it's still, you know, boardwalk, amusement park, the beach, but the residential area of Coney Island is a 30-square-block area devoted to almost nothing but housing projects, vacant lots, and basketball courts sort of nestled in between the buildings. And the kids that I wrote about play at a neighborhood court that they've called the Garden after Madison Square Garden. And it's really where the most disciplined and aspiring players go to play. And it's really, you go there and you think you're going to watch a sort of normal playground pickup game, and what you see is this incredibly intense, disciplined five-on-five contest with coaches and drills and sometimes referees brought in to officiate the games. It's really quite a sight.
So the kids who you were writing about were trying to perfect their basketball skills to get to college, but they also had to try to improve their academic record to get that basketball scholarship.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, actually, one of the things that basketball does is it does provide this carrot that inspires kids who might not otherwise take their academics that seriously to hit the books because they want to remain eligible in college. But one of the interesting things I found out, the hero of my story is this kid named Russell Thomas, who was as devoted to his schoolwork as he was to basketball. He used to, at the end of every practice, he'd go home with a stack of SAT review books, vocabulary, flashcards. He was studying like crazy to pass these tests and to try to keep himself eligible. And actually, one of the very sad things about reporting this book was watching him in his senior year struggling over and over again with a standardized test that made him increasingly demoralized.
Why was it so hard for him to prepare for the SATs?
Well, the SAT, the standard that the NCAA has set for incoming college athletes is a combined score of 700, which doesn't seem on the outset, or it didn't to me, as a terribly rigorous standard. But these kids are coming from years and years of poor educations. And then by the time they become seniors in high school, they're sitting down to answer algebra and reading comprehension questions on the SATs when they've barely learned the fundamentals of multiplication or even finished a book. And they're coming to it with none of the advantages that suburban kids, say, who have taken Stanley Kaplan review courses have had. And one of the other things, Russell Thomas had nerves of steel on the court. He could not be fazed even if the game was on the line. When he sat down in front of the SATs, knowing how much was at stake, he would panic and he just couldn't perform.
You give some statistics in your book, and you say that after Proposition 48 was put into effect by the NCAA, requiring the 700 SAT point average, that 91% of the kids who became ineligible for college basketball were black.
That's right, and they're sort of grimly referred to as Prop 48 casualties. 91% since the rule had been set up in 1986 have been black, 9% have been white. There's an incredible racial, cultural divide. I had a real sort of, critics of the standardized tests have been complaining for years that they're culturally biased, and I had a very specific idea of what that meant after spending 8 or 9 months with the kids on the team and watching them struggle with the test. I actually opened it up and took a look at it, and my eye lit on a verbal question that said, name a synonym for panache. And it just sort of hit me. How is a kid, having grown up all his life in that projects in Coney Island, going to know the answer to that?
The funny thing is that these are kids who display panache on the court, but they wouldn't wouldn't necessarily know the word for it.
That's right, and they're quick, they're bright, they're just not prepared for such things. They're poorly schooled, and that's the dilemma.
Journalist Darcy Frey is my guest. He's the author of the new book, The Last Shot: City Streets, Basketball Dreams. You went to a Nike summer camp with one of the players who you write about. This is their ABCD program, which stands for Academic Betterment and Career Development Program.
Right.
Tell us a little bit about what this Nike camp was like.
Well, the Nike shoe company bills this as a sort of fresh air camp for inner city kids where they'll brush up on their schoolwork and play a little bit of basketball. What it really is a week-long jamboree where Nike invites the 120 top high school basketball players in the country to play in Indianapolis every summer with plane fare, hotel, food, shirts, shorts, sneakers, all paid in full by Nike, which is an astonishing amount of largesse that gets passed on to the kids. That would be a blatantly illegal inducement if it actually came from a college coach, but the NCAA has no jurisdiction over the sneaker companies. The camp is basically games all day long where the players, almost all of them black, run back and forth on three separate courts in front of bleachers filled with college, Division I college coaches, almost all of them white, watching the kids, appraising them, and basically scrutinizing every physical attribute of the players. And a number of analogies have been drawn, and probably the most charitable one that I saw actually appeared as a headline in the Indianapolis News the week that I was out there. It said, "Camp resembles State Fair cattle exhibition." It really is a meat market.
Now, there is some time for academic work at the camp. There's math and English classes through the morning.
That's right. And to some degree, it's better teaching and more attention than some of the kids have ever seen in high school. But it does the kids good. But there's a serious profit motive that goes on with the camp, and the reason why the shoe company stages it. A number of years ago, Nike began signing up all the top college coaches to exclusive endorsement contracts, which meant that if you were a coach in the Big East, say at Seton Hall or Villanova, if you signed with Nike and you got a nice six-figure annual stipend from the shoe company, you had to make sure that your players were wearing Nike sneakers. And this, you know, basically the kids became walking billboards for the sneaker companies. The Nike camp is a sort of extension of this marketing strategy. It allows Nike to reach ever deeper into the game, to bring even the best high school players into the corporate fold, so that a kid who's a star athlete will go to a high school team sponsored by Nike, help spend his summers at a summer camp sponsored by Nike, and then in all likelihood he'll sign with a college sponsored by Nike. And if he becomes the next NBA superstar, the next Michael Jordan or David Robinson, he's most likely going to sign his exclusive endorsement contract with Nike.
You went to this Nike summer camp with one of the students you were following named Chaka.
Mm-hmm.
What was the experience like for him?
Enormous pressure. I think that we have this idea that that these kids are getting almost a free ride, and that the recruiting and the exposure, the lavishness of it all just goes to a kid's head, and the greatest casualty is if a player gets a big head. These kids are under enormous pressure, and Chaka felt it during the week that he was out there. Here's a 17-year-old kid who has to face pressures and perform in a fashion that most of us never have to in our lives. And he's got to do it at a time when there's so little for him to fall back on if his dream of using basketball to get to college doesn't work out.
Well, he became the first player at Lincoln High ever to attract the interest of all the schools in the Big East Conference. And you were with him as some of the coaches came to his high school to try to talk him into signing up. Tell us a little bit about the strategies different coaches used to convince him to join their team.
For most of the fall of the year that I spent with the team, every Big East coach, as you said, came in. Raleigh Massimino, who was then of Villanova, Jim Boeheim of Syracuse, PJ Carlesimo, then of Seton Hall. They all come in with a different pitch. Jim Boeheim promised Chaka he would have a starting position as a freshman. That was his way of romancing Chaka. Chaka and his friends all had a suspicion about Jim Boeheim. Boeheim has a reputation on the street as for recruiting over, which means signing up an athlete and then giving his starting spot to a better athlete if one should come along. So Chaka was vaguely suspicious of Jim Boeheim. Raleigh Massimino came in and promised Chaka that if he signed with Villanova, he would be part of a warm and loving family, that Chaka and Massimino would be lifelong friends. There was something that made Chaka suspicious of that pitch as well, and it turned out to be well-founded, because the next year, Massimino jumped ship and started coaching at the University of Nevada at Las Vegas. The coaches come in with all sorts of promises. If a kid signs with a college, he has got to go to that college. He must honor his commitment to go to the college. But there are no NCAA rules that bind the coaches similarly to make them honor their commitments to the kids.
Do you think that a lot of players choose a college based on which sneaker company has an endorsement contract with the coach there?
I met a kid actually at the Nike camp who had been in the Nike system since he was basically in fifth grade. He had played on Nike teams throughout his prep school career, and he told me once, I want to go to a Nike college, because if I go to Providence, I got to wear Converse. If I go to Villanova, I got to wear LA gear. So I'm going to go to one of the Nike colleges. And it's easy to laugh at that, but this is just adolescent, interest in fashion, except in this case, the colleges and the sneaker companies are in line to profit greatly from a sort of adolescent decision like that.
Chaka signed with Seton Hall. What happened to him there?
PJ Carlesimo came in, recruited him. One of the reasons why Chaka signed with Seton Hall was that he was promised ample playing time, chance to play at small forward, where Chaka thought his skills would really shine. After 2 years at Seton Hall, Chaka had averaged only 3 minutes a game. He was being used as a backup center. And ultimately, I think that he felt that he had been lied to by the coaches there as much as the coaches that he decided not to sign with. And he decided to transfer after 2 years to the University of California at Irvine, a lower-level school where he thought he might get a chance to start. A terrible thing happened to Chaka just this past summer, though, when he was going out to California to start his career out there. He got into an awful car accident, which has kept him off the team this year. And I think it's up in the air whether the schools are going to honor the scholarship, even though he can't play ball.
And if a school doesn't honor the scholarship, he's out of college.
Unless he can find another way to fund his college education. You know, even the kids who sign on to Division I schools have a really hard time making it through. They're spending 25, 35 hours a week traveling to games and practices, so they fall behind in their schoolwork. And then fewer than half of Division I athletes will graduate in less than 5 years. Though they only have 4 years of athletic eligibility, often their scholarships run out and they're left, either they have to drop out without a degree or they have to find some other way to fund the rest of their schooling. I think one of the things the NCAA ought to consider is if a kid plays 4 good years on a team, that kid should be able to stay in college as long as it takes him to earn his degree. He's made money by virtue of ticket sales and television contracts for that school, and that school still has an obligation to the kid so that he can get an education.
My guest is journalist Darcy Frey, author of the new book, The Last Shot, City Streets, Basketball Dreams. We'll be back after a break. This is Fresh Air. With Darcy Frey, author of the new book, The Last Shot, City Streets, Basketball Dreams. You write in your book that many people think of basketball scholarships as the black version of the American dream, but you've reached the conclusion that it's really a cruel parody of the American dream.
You know, yeah, I did think it was the sort of black version of the American dream when I started out. In the classic parable of the American dream, you know, you start out with nothing and you slowly accrue your riches through hard work in a system that's designed to help those who help themselves. Here, in this system, you start out at the age of 16, 17 years old with one narrow, treacherous path that's really strewn with all sorts of obstacles that merely reminds you of how little you have. You've got recruiters passing themselves off as father figures. You've got standardized tests that are humiliating if you've come from a disadvantaged educational background. You've got the promise of these multi-million dollar NBA contracts that ultimately reminds you of what it feels like to go through life with nothing in this world. And so I think it is a cruel hoax that's played on these kids.
And yet, I mean, some of the kids who you wrote about are really much better off because of basketball scholarships.
It's a double-edged sword. Scholarships and basketball offers kids exposure. It gives them motivation to study. For the very few, like Chaka, they end up getting a Division I college scholarship. But they are in peril of being exploited every step of the way. And the exploitation begins much earlier than just late high school and college. These kids, the star athletes in New York City and elsewhere, are recruited from the time they're in fifth grade by the junior high schools, the high schools, the summer camps, the summer leagues. You know, basketball for these kids is a year-round activity, and every month of the year there's a different coach who wants a piece of these kids.
How do you think the system could be changed so that the kids aren't exploited but still have opportunities?
Well, I think as long as big-time college basketball is going to be grafted onto our system of higher education, then such things as Prop 48, which puts a lot of personal responsibility on the kids to hit the books and get good SAT scores, is fine. But the high schools and the colleges, the institutions themselves, have to be equally committed to educating these players. And there are all sorts of things the NCAA could consider doing besides eligibility requirements for the players that they never do, which would put responsibility on the colleges. For instance, they could ban freshman eligibility in college across the board, so every player's first year in school is devoted entirely to schoolwork and academics. But You know, there's a lot of money that comes into the schools if they recruit top high school freshmen. So the NCAA never considers that. Another thing they could consider doing is denying schools their coveted Division I status if their players don't graduate. But again, that's something that, you know, the colleges will lose their Division I status. They won't get their television contracts. And those choices that the NCAA could make but don't make, I think, puts the lie to the idea that they really care as much about academics as they do about athletics. In high school and in college, on both levels, academics has really become the subset to sports, not the other way around.
Why shouldn't a gifted athlete be recognized for their athletic achievement without the burden of achieving a good academic standing?
You know, if academics and athletics are going to be separated, and college basketball is going to be seen as a big business, which in fact it is. You know, the Big East Conference got $65 million for a one-year contract with CBS Sports. If it's going to be commerce pure and simple, then these players should be called professionals, which is what they are, and they should be paid. And the NCAA should not use their amateur status guidelines to keep the players from getting paid. I actually think that players ought to receive some sort of stipend for the services that they render to their teams on the court.
I'm interested in talking to you about an ethical dilemma that you were in the middle of. You had told the families of the young men that you were writing about that you would share the book's profits with them.
That's right. Actually, one of the parents of the players said that if he were to cooperate with my reporting efforts, I had to pay him. And at first, I just said, no, I can't do that. That's, you know, reporters can't pay people for information. That's checkbook journalism. That's what the National Enquirer does. Over time, though, when we went back and forth with negotiations over a period of months, I realized that my book was becoming more and more about how these kids were getting exploited by the system of college athletics. And I didn't want to put myself in the same exploitative relationship with the families. And I actually decided that I would share whatever profit the book might make with the families of the principal players in the book. The NCAA stepped in, though, at that point and said that the kids would lose their amateur status and it would jeopardize their eligibility to play college basketball. And so the deal fell through.
One of the parents decided not to talk with you anymore, not to let his son talk with you anymore, after he could no longer share in the profits from the book.
That's right. There was the father of one player who wanted some compensation. The mother of another player her son's recruiting was sort of hanging in the balance, and she felt that anybody, whether it was a reporter like me or actually even her son's girlfriend, who she persuaded him to break up with, anyone who was going to distract him in any fashion from this tenuous passage out of poverty that he was on was going to be a threat to him. And so she told her son not to talk to me anymore. In fact, when these two things happened and when the NCAA banned me from the college campuses, I actually thought that my book had fallen apart. And after several months of trying to figure out what to do with this material, I decided, in fact, it was going to be a third-person book, a sort of omnisciently narrated book. I decided to put some of those obstacles that I encountered as a reporter in the book, write it in the first person, because I thought that the things that I encountered were some of the most illuminating and revealing things that I learned about the situation the kids themselves were in, the desperate need for money, the suspicion of anyone who might exploit them, and the great hypocrisy of NCAA rules that prevent these kids from profiting in any fashion from their skill.
Darcy Frey, thank you very much for talking with us.
Well, thanks for having me on the show.
Darcy Frey is the author of The Last Shot, City Streets, Basketball Dreams. He's a contributing editor at Harper's and the New York Times Magazine. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Subaru used to sell cars with the slogan, inexpensive and built to stay that way. But in 1991, it was ready for a new image. Six top advertising agencies competed for the account, and the agency that built Nike's successful advertising campaign won. But what the agency did for Nike, they couldn't do for Subaru. Coming up, a look at what went wrong with Subaru's ad campaign. We talk with journalist Randall Rothenberg about his new book, Where the Suckers Moon, an Advertising Story. And classical music critic Roy Schwartz reviews Christopher O'Reilly's solo piano versions of three Stravinsky scores. That's all coming up on Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Laura Kanoy. House Republicans made it official today, naming Georgia's Newt Gingrich as Speaker of the House. The Republican caucus also selected other party leaders. UPI's Carol Van Dam has the story.
In a rather lengthy acceptance speech, Gingrich pledged to make real and substantive changes that make a difference in people's lives.
Until we have a roadmap of where we're going, we can't distinguish between activity and progress. And we know that the great society has failed.
Other Republicans referred to Gingrich as a visionary, one who will not only set the tone for the House of Representatives, but for the country and the entire world. Like Gingrich, Texas Republican Richard Armey was uncontested for the number two post of majority leader, and Republicans elected sixth-term Republican Tom DeLay of Texas for the number three post of majority whip. DeLay beat out Pennsylvania's Bob Walker and Florida's Bill McCollum for the job. Carol Van Dam, Capitol Hill.
White House Chief of Staff Leon Panetta angrily denounced Gingrich today for commenting this weekend that nearly a quarter of White House staff has used illegal drugs in recent years. Panetta said no one in the White House uses drugs, and that Gingrich has to start behaving like a Speaker of the House, not, in Panetta's words, like some out-of-control radio talk show host. Federal regulators say the nation's pension gap has grown by more than a third to $71 million. The shortfall is the difference between pensions promised to American workers and the money actually put aside to cover them. The Federal Pension Benefit Guarantee Corporation says 8 million workers and retirees are covered by underfunded plans. Congress did pass a bill last week aimed at reducing the shortfall. Japan's top government spokesman says Tokyo is still waiting for a response from the United States to Japan's opposition to a U.S. commemorative stamp depicting the atomic bombings of Hiroshima and Nagasaki. From Tokyo, NPR's Julie McCarthy reports.
The U.S. Postal Service, in collaboration with the State and Defense Departments, announced plans last week to issue a series of stamps commemorating the 50th anniversary of the end of World War II. The one that Japan has asked be withdrawn features mushroom clouds with a caption, "Atomic bombs hasten war's end." The stamp has infuriated the Japanese. An exhibition at the Smithsonian Institution in Washington displaying the Enola Gay, the plane that dropped the first atomic bomb on Hiroshima, has already stirred ill feelings between Japan and the United States. The latest flap over the stamp prompted one U.S. official to say, "The idea that the 50th anniversary could be a time for mutual understandings looks further and further away." In Tokyo, this is Julie McCarthy.
The Commerce Department says new home sales were up 1.3% in October, the highest level in nearly a year. Analysts had expected sales to drop because of rising mortgage rates. On Wall Street, stocks closed mixed today. The Dow Jones Industrial Average fell 3.7. This is NPR. White House aides say President Clinton is getting close to choosing a new agriculture secretary. Outgoing Secretary Mike Espy leaves office New Year's Eve. The president is reportedly looking at several farm state members of Congress who lost re-election, including Dan Glickman of Kansas and Indiana's Jill Long. He may decide to promote the current deputy secretary, Richard Rominger. Rominger used to be a farmer and ran California's agriculture department for nearly 15 years. Authorities in New Jersey may file criminal charges against the owner of the El Balcon Club in Elizabeth after four people were killed in a stampede there over the weekend. Officials say the club's exit doors were locked or were too difficult to find. There are also reports of overcrowding and of alcohol being served to minors. Syrian officials have convinced Lebanon's prime minister to stay on. Last week, the prime minister said he was resigning following a political dispute. Ed Uranian reports from Beirut.
Prime Minister Rafiq al-Hariri's decision to remain at his post came after 2 days of intense negotiations with Syrian officials. Syria apparently believes that Hariri's leadership makes for political and economic stability in Lebanon. A bitter row over political power between Hariri and Parliament Speaker Nabi Berri seems to have triggered the crisis last week. No word has yet come over the formation of a new government, one of Hariri's principal demands. Rival politicians have been accusing one another of corruption since a drug scandal broke last month. Hariri's threatened resignation sparked a wave of panic in Beirut's financial markets. Many Lebanese feared that it might provoke renewed instability in a country that's just beginning to recover from 16 years of civil war. For National Public Radio, this is Edward Uranian in Beirut.
Ukraine has signed the Nuclear Non-Proliferation Treaty and the START 1 Nuclear Arms Reduction Treaty at a European summit in Hungary today. In exchange, the U.S. promised Ukraine security guarantees. I'm Laura Kanoy in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Have you driven a Ford lately? I love what you do for me, Toyota. The heartbeat of America, that's today's Chevrolet. How do advertising agencies come up with these slogans? Do they really sell cars? Randall Rothenberg was given permission by Subaru to follow the creation of its new ad campaign during 1991 and 92. Rothenberg is the former advertising columnist for the New York Times. His new book, We're the Sucker's Moon, an Advertising Story, chronicles Subaru's failed attempt to overhaul its image. He told me about some of the problems that led Subaru to look for a new ad agency.
Subaru first came into the United States in 1969. It was a cheap and ugly little car. And after several fits and starts, during which the company nearly went bankrupt several times, it really zoomed to success in the early to mid-80s by selling cars that were known as inexpensive and durable. It also became known as a quirky manufacturer of four-wheel drive autos that were especially popular in the Northeast and the Northwest. What happened to Subaru, and its slogan was for about 16 years, inexpensive and built to stay that way. What happened in the mid-1980s, when the United States was really in the throes of a trade crisis with Japan and other trading partners, the government successfully jawboned Japan into raising the value of the yen against the dollar. What that did is it made Japanese products much more expensive in the United States. Where the other Japanese auto manufacturers could spread those price increases across more lines of cars, Subaru, which is a very small company in Japan, had to raise its prices. So within 2 years, between 1986 and 1988, the price of Subarus at retail doubled. And this was a car that was known as inexpensive and built to stay that way. Unfortunately, it was no longer inexpensive. So they had to do something to continue to attract people to a product that was no longer what it had been.
When Subaru was shopping for an advertising agency, there were agencies that pitched all kinds of different campaigns that would reposition the car in the marketplace. Will you give us a brief taste of what some of the alternatives were that Subaru turned down?
Yeah, there were. Subaru ended up reviewing initially about 25 or 30 agencies, then selecting six to make the final pitch, and they were six very different agencies from six different parts of the country with six very different ways of approaching advertising. And I think a measure of the difficulty a company faces when it's put in this situation does boil down to the six slogans that they presented. And what they were, one agency pitched Subaru, the car that will change your mind. Another agency pitched Subaru for all the right reasons. Third agency suggested Subaru, the perfect car for an imperfect world. Fourth agency recommended get real, get a Subaru. Fifth agency recommended that the company position itself as Subaru, cars that can. And the sixth agency suggested that Subaru position itself as Subaru, what to drive. All six of the agencies agreed that on the target market. They said that Subaru customers were well-educated, middle to upper middle class, in white-collar professions, and that all of them in the target market considered themselves not swayed by fashion and fancy and trends. So it was an appeal to the intelligence of the Subaru driver that they were trying to get at, and those six slogans were the kickers that were supposed to attract those kind of people.
The slogan that won was the one that goes, Subaru, what to drive. And that was the slogan that was pitched by Wieden and Kennedy, the advertising firm that Subaru decided to go with. What struck a chord with that slogan?
It was very surprising. Wieden and Kennedy in Portland is best known for its ads for Nike. It's probably the exemplar of this form of postmodern creative advertising in the United States. It's known as a wildly creative agency. In fact, Subaru put them in the review as the creative wild card. But in fact, what won the account for the agency was not necessarily its creative recommendation, but the strategy. What Wieden and Kennedy suggested was that Subaru position itself as a fashion item for intellectuals go against the idea of cars as and car buyers as swayed by trends. So it was basically saying cars are just machines. They get you from point A to point B. We have a good machine. You can trust us. The second thing that Wieden and Kennedy did was it presented a very, very well thought out media plan that showed how Subaru should allocate its $75 million of advertising money to those markets where it could gain the best incremental sales. It didn't just kind of lay everything off on national network advertising.
My guest is Randall Rothenberg, author of the new book, Where the Suckers Moon, an Advertising Story. We'll be back after this break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Randall Rothenberg, former advertising columnist at the New York Times. His new book follows the development of a Subaru ad campaign. What was the ad like to showcase, how did you put it, a fashion statement for intellectuals?
Right. What it was it was shot in kind of the socialist heroic mold of the 1930s and 40s, the design that we remember from the WPA art and from Life magazine, or more contemporarily, from Sebastio Salgado's photographs. And it was inside an auto factory with beautiful black and white and kind of washed out color shots of factory machines making the car. And then there was scrolling type going up that was read in a voiceover by, of all people, Brian Keith, who we remember from Family Affair in the 1960s. And the text was, a car is just a car. Its main purpose for existence is to get you from point A to point B. It won't make you more handsome or smarter or prettier. And if your friends say it will, then you live among snobs with distorted values. And it was a very, very popular launch ad. The dealers, Subaru dealers, loved it. The corporate executives loved it. Unfortunately, the public kind of ignored it.
Yeah, I don't even remember it.
That spot premiered around Labor Day of 1991. Between Labor Day and the end of 1991, the company had very little money to spend, so it only ran sporadically. But because it had launched this campaign with such fanfare, when it didn't achieve results by the end of 1991, Subaru's dealers, who are the real powers in any car company, rebelled. And so the company frantically began to try to rejigger the campaign, to come up with new ads and new ideas that would help sell cars.
How did the dealers rebel?
Well, they did several things. First of all, it's important for people out there to understand that auto manufacturers don't sell cars to consumers. They sell cars to dealers who sell cars to consumers. Dealers are the powerhouses. In this case, the way dealers rebel is they curtail the number of cars they're buying from the manufacturer. They put a lot of pressure on the manufacturer's regional sales executives. They start arguing for different things in the ads. What Subaru's dealers did was they argued vociferously for more sheet metal. That's what they call the car in the ad. They wanted more sheet metal. They wanted more...
They wanted to see more car?
They wanted to see more car. And they wanted to see other things. I mean, you got to remember, most auto dealers overwhelmingly are men. Most of them have been in this business for a long time. They've either had their dealerships passed down by their families or they rose up from the sales floor. They have very, very definite notions of what needs to be in ads. At one point, there was a meeting where Wieden & Kennedy presented yet another take on this ad, yet another way to appeal to people's minds. And the sales executives in this meeting started arguing back and forth vociferously about there should be more stuff about the power of the engine. There should be more talk about the styling. There should be more focus on the sports car, not the other cars. And at the end of this totally disastrous meeting, when everybody is breaking up and the agency is shell-shocked, one sales executive came over to one of the Wieden & Kennedy executives and looked at him and very knowingly said, I'll use a euphemism here, said, what you really need in this ad is a babe with big breasts. That's how they think.
After the dealers rebelled against the ad campaign, Wieden & Kennedy came up with another slogan, the official car of the recession.
Yes.
How did that play?
Well, 1991, 1992 is the worst post-war recession we had. Subaru cars were always known as great buys. They were known as durable. The agency thought that you can combine those two in a very risky but straightforward campaign that took real public cognizance of the recession. Subaru was real interested in that. The executives thought it was risky, but head on, it said exactly what needed to be said, and combined with good film would really make the dealers happy and ram consumers right between the eyes. But what happened in the end was that it went up several chains of command, back and forth, and the chief operating officer of the company, the president of the company, thought it was so risky that he wanted to get two outside public relations agencies to pass judgment on the campaign and make a determination of how it would play with consumers. And one agency said, yeah, it's risky, but it'll work. And the other agency said, it won't work. And the other agency, in fact, suggested that Subaru get a spokesperson. Somebody like Tony Bennett would be for an Italian car. And I remember the meeting was the head of Subaru in Philadelphia kind of shaking his head and say, oh, you mean somebody like Yoko Ono? So that's how the campaign died. They just were afraid to go with it.
Did you buy a car during the period you were writing your book?
No, I did not. I lived in Manhattan, and I think that you've got to be either very nuts or very rich to own a car in Manhattan.
Did you talk to any of the people at the advertising agency who did the Subaru campaign about whether they thought ads affected them the last time they bought cars?
I'm sorry, repeat the question.
Did you talk to any of the people who did the Subaru advertising campaign about whether they felt ads affected their choice the last time they bought cars?
Yeah, I did. And in fact, ads affected their choice the way political advertising affects people's choices of in voting, negatively. So many of them were so turned off by the ads they saw that they went around them. They wouldn't buy a car because the ads were too glitzy or seemed too false. They were turned off by the whole sales process, which is why they wanted to create a campaign that that worked against the conventions of auto advertising.
Now, how did that campaign work against the conventions of auto advertising?
Well, in part by making conscious reference to those conventions. One of the conventions of postmodern advertising is the constant self-reference. It's the kind of advertising that says explicitly or implicitly, "Hey, we're an ad. You know we're an ad, and we know we're an ad. So that means we're being honest with you, and you can trust what we're saying." And so that Subaru advertisement that said, look, a car is just a car. It's only going to get you from point A to point B. And all that other crap about cars can make you handsomer and more intelligent, you know, we all know that's not true. So that's what they did. That was their way of exposing the conventions of auto advertising. And they did that consistently throughout the campaign, again, through self-reference, through a continual acknowledgement that we are an ad. And a lot of advertising out there for a lot of products does that today, and it again has the effect of washing itself out.
What do you mean by washing itself out?
Well, if you've got a dozen ads on television for different products that are all saying, hey, we're an advertisement. You know we're an ad, and we know we're an ad, so you can trust us. Well, people will begin to see that this is yet another convention of advertising, just like the glitzy product shot at the end, just like the beautiful long blonde-haired women, and they will not trust it. And I think there's a great deal of distrust out there now for ads that say, oh, we're ads, so you can trust us.
Randall Rothenberg is the author of Where the Suckers Moon, An Advertising Story. This is Fresh Air. Newt Gingrich was elected Speaker of the House today. Linda Wertheimer's with us. Linda, what will you have on that on All Things Considered?
It was a unanimous vote on by acclamation. No one even spoke against him in the Republican caucus, Terry. So we will be taking a look at Mr. Gingrich's leadership and at the committees of Congress, how he is organizing them, how he is changing them, and who he's picked to head them. Also, Mr. Gingrich outlined a kind of GOP Bosnia policy over the weekend, and we're going to get a critique of that policy from some experts on Bosnia and talk about whether or not it looks like what Mr. Gingrich wants to do would work.
Thanks, Linda. That and more on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. Some of Stravinsky's best-known ballet and theater scores were adapted for the piano by Stravinsky and others. There's a new recording of three of these solo piano versions by pianist Christopher O'Reilly. Music critic Lloyd Schwartz loves the performances, but has some reservations about the adaptations themselves. Here's Lloyd's review.
Stravinsky was not only a composer and a conductor, but also a concert pianist, and he composed some of his most colorful scores on the piano. Yet he didn't compose very much for solo piano. His piano masterpiece is three movements from Petrushka, music taken from his dazzling and poignant ballet about a puppet at a Russian fair. The musical germ for this score was a kind of piano concerto, so the piano was involved from the very beginning. His version for solo piano captures the richness and exhilaration of the whole orchestra. Firebrand pianist Christopher O'Reilly gives one of the most brilliant, characterful, and life-affirming performances of it I've ever heard.
Thank you.
The two other pieces on this album are fascinating but problematical. They're both reductions for the piano of two stage works, presumably made for rehearsal purposes but not by the composer himself. O'Reilly even puts back extra notes from the complete scores to give these versions more concert credibility. L'Histoire du Soldat was a theater piece originally written for a small ensemble of winds, percussion, and bass with a featured role for solo violin. The hero is a young soldier who sells his violin to the devil. But the dramatic contrast between violin and winds is, of course, lost in the piano reduction. The piano version of the ballet Apollo is even stranger. This sublime score was originally for string orchestra. It's like Tchaikovsky, smooth, melodic, but with surprising rhythms and the harmony askew. On the piano, the tone is completely different. There's no legato. Rhythms, harmonies, and the melodic outline are clearer and beautiful, but something's missing. The shimmering ambiguities of the strings sometimes come out sounding like a player piano accompanying a sentimental parlor ballad. Whatever my reservations, Christopher O'Reilly plays everything on this disc with such fullness and imaginative power. Even when the music sounds wrong, I want to hear it over and over. And when it's right, as in Petrushka, it's heaven.
Lord Schwartz is the classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed Christopher O'Reilly playing piano versions of three Stravinsky orchestral scores on Elektra Nonesuch. Fresh Air's senior producer is Danny Miller. Our program was produced today by Fred Landerl. Our engineers this week are Joyce Lieberman and Chris Fraley. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is now available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $9.95 plus shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by this and other NPR member stations. Additional support comes from the George Gund Foundation. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, electronic money. In the near future, all your financial transactions may be handled through one card, making hard currency just about obsolete. We'll talk with computer journalist Stephen Levy, who writes about e-money in the new edition of Wired magazine. I'm Terry Gross. I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.